I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hello, I'm Scott Soschnick.
And I'm Evan Novy Williams, and this is the Pirate Ship Sails Back to Betting sports business podcast, The Sportacast.
Normally I grade it. I don't get it. Explain.
Well, Pirate Ship is how Dave Portnoy and a lot of the Barstool folks describe the new era of non-Penn ownership. When Penn sold Barstool back to Dave Portnoy for a dollar, it was a return to Barstool's Pirate Ship ways, is the way that they all discuss what era they're in right now.
Okay, so if we're going through well-known pirates, give me who would Dave be.
Oh man, my pirate knowledge is, I gotta
you
admit,
know
it's
enough
quite
pirates
small.
Come on,
I know Blackbeard, I know Sir Francis Drake, I know the guy from the Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
Johnny Depp's
yeah,
all
Kurt,
right now.
Kurt Button has not weighed in here.
I would say the swashbuckling guy from the movie would be Dave. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, there you go. Yeah,
taking bites of pizza and letting the world know what he thinks. DeBloom and pizza, right? That's all we need to know. Anyway, the important news here, Mr. Novy Williams, is that Barstool, which we all knew licensed its name to Penn, the thinking being that all the stoolies, see that reference I know, they would simply, due to brand loyalty, rush to anything that was branded Barstool Bet, Barstool Sportsbook, and say, this is where I'm going to go and put my money. And, well, things just didn't really work out that way. And, of course, the heavily regulated world of gaming didn't really dovetail nicely with Dave the Pirate, so to speak. So that was unwound. And wait a minute, like, I look up, and here they are again getting back into sports betting in a very – I'm trying to see what surprises me here. The fact that they're going back in, I mean, I understand it's a different deal, and you'll explain that. Or if I'm Penn, that I only had such a short lockup period that here they are knocking on my door again.
Yeah, I think you nailed it there, Scott. There's two stories happening here simultaneously.
Kurt, and did you hear that? I nailed it.
And shout out to Kurt Bodenhausen, our colleague.
Special day when Bodenhausen joins. Must be some valuations we're going to talk about.
Sportacast returning champion.
Jump in whenever you want, though, Kurt. You can really just talk right over Novy Williams. It's easy.
But yeah, I think the more interesting part of this story, Scott, is the Penn piece of this. That Penn paid an aggregate $500-something million to buy Barstool. They wrote off $850 million when they sold it back to Dave Portnoy for a dollar. The Barstool sports book did not work, and the economics failed, and Penn lost a lot of money on it. And not only did Penn give away Barstool back to Dave, but there's clearly value in this in some way. And a lot of people have asked me, Scott, in the past 6 months since that deal was announced, what's the lockup period here? If Barstool wants to get back into betting in some capacity, how long did Penn restrict them from doing so? And the answer is 6 months, from what I understand.
Football season. It's football season.
The end of the football season. I think this DraftKings, unless something goes horribly wrong, this DraftKings Barstool deal is going to be announced right after the Super Bowl. The fact that Penn didn't even have the leverage to negotiate a way for that Barstool wouldn't help one of ESPN Bet and Penn's biggest competitors moving forward, I think, is one of the most fascinating parts of this. So yeah, I think there's a Barstool story here, but it's also a continuing story of the business mistake that Penn made when it got in bed with Barstool in the first place, and also how that deal was unwound.
Well, clearly Wall Street, at least some investors, liked it, because in the minutes right after our story hit, you saw a bump in DraftKings stock. So
yeah,
People at least liked the idea. I think have we come back to earth yet? I haven't looked since we started recording. But it looked as if, you know, folks were liking the fact that brand anyway was going to be involved in sports betting.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, because the again, the Barstool Sportsbook did not work. It didn't work economically. And obviously DraftKings believes there is value in having Barstool as a partner. And to be clear, this deal that they're talking about doesn't create a new Barstool Sportsbook. It's always going to be DraftKings. It's just a marketing deal. Dave Portnoy and everyone at Barstool will talk about DraftKings odds. They'll mention DraftKings. They can share in the economics of people that they refer to DraftKings. But Barstool has a largely young male avid betting consumer. That is true. The question is, does that convert? Is there a way to convert that into a sticky, loyal betting customer? Penn obviously failed with that. We'll see how DraftKings does. But it's interesting to me that the market loves this because, at least so far, I think DraftKings has struggled, or Barstool rather, has struggled a little bit to be a funnel for a specific sports book.
Well, Eben, this is actually going to dovetail nicely here. Did you know I met Kurt Bodenhausen at the OTB on like 70th Street on the Upper West Side? He and I were both in our dirty, stained white T-shirts. He was a cigar smoker at the side, so he was just chomping on it. I think we were
betting
we
on
were,
Phillies and I think Santa
we were
Ana.
Both, yeah, we were both eyeing the Sixth and Aqueduct. I think it was a horse called Broken Down Business or something like that.
It was a mutter,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, a tough mutter, and yeah, I think we lost our shirts that day. But so now we decided like work together and do other things. Bodenhausen usually
this is
on
a
valuation
Boston beat. Story also, right? This is a Boston story also,
yes.
Right?
Two Boston
companies coming
Look
together.
I was going to say, why don't you give me your take on what you see here? That's
it,
apart
I
from
see it as a Boston story. There you go.
More dirty water.
And we should shout out, Scott, our Sportico, Erica Ayres-Badan, who is the former now Barstool CEO, was at an event of ours in December. She kind of hinted at the idea that Barstool would be getting back into betting at that event. So there's a little bit of a shout out to our events as well. Something that happened on stage in December with us. But yeah, this it's going to be fascinating to see how this works out. The sports betting business writ large is still kind of stuck in this world where they're paying big money to media companies, to podcasts for customer acquisition. And everybody, and DraftKings is among them, everyone talks about this future world where they're entrenched in their business well enough to not need to do it in the same way that Uber and Lyft talked about that a decade ago. But there's still, it's early days, sure, but there's still an open question about, is there a future where these companies don't need to spend this much money to acquire new customers? And maybe they don't need huge marketing deals like this one.
I always say, how do and why do? We've talked about UX. We've talked about brand affinity. We've talked about, for me, if I was going to go place a bet, I want the best line. That's like the only thing that matters to me is who's giving me a half a point. Like, I just don't understand why I would pick one over the other, like DraftKings versus FanDuel versus, you know, whatever, PointsBet, which may be more towards your sophisticated gambler. But if one had, you know, if I wanted to go one way on a game and it had an extra half point, that's the one I'm using. Like, even if I'm loyal to one of them, I'm going the other way. I don't get it. Like, I'm riding New Jersey Transit. I'm getting bombarded with ads for both companies. I don't care. I just want to win money.
You say that often, Scott. You are definitely in a minority there, and I'm curious. I don't know if you gamble.
I'm very comfortable being in the minority.
But the truth is, or from people I talk to in the industry, is that price sensitivity is really not that baked in.
I don't understand how that can be.
And as soon as these companies know that you're price sensitive, Scott, you're like the least valuable customer.
Yeah, of course.
Right? You're the guy who doesn't bet very much money and actually cares.
But I don't
about
understand
the price.
How everybody. What's the whole purpose of doing it? The purpose is to win, right? It's to win the bet. If somebody makes it more attractive for me to go on one of the game I'm interested in, if I bet more money, maybe there's like, there should be a promotion. And stop me if there is. I don't know this. But let's say I reach it. Like, I go to Starbucks, I get stars, I get free stuff. Okay. Yep. So I've made this, I've wagered X amount of dollars. So on my next bet, I get the option of moving a half point on the line one way or the other. Give me that. I'll be loyal to that sports book. That's the one I want to go with.
You can buy a half point at some of these, obviously.
Yeah, but that changes the odds. Exactly. But I don't want that. I want, as a loyal customer, I want the ability to change the odd because I'm loyal to you.
Yeah, there is, again, there's so much uncertainty about what people are loyal to. Is it pricing? It doesn't seem to be. Is it UX experience? I think to a degree. there's kind of two tiers, in my opinion. There's a few sports books that are all on the same tier of very efficient, easy to get money in and out, and the UX experience is okay. And then there's a number of them that are bad at that. There are people out there that are just got the first one or the one that was giving them the most money and got kind of stuck in a habit of using that. But from a product standpoint, which is the point you're making, Scott, yeah, there's very little differentiation.
Yeah.
And one of the questions is partnering with, is being the one that Dave Portnoy talks about to the millions of people that listen to him on betting advice and stock advice and all of the shows that Barstool has, is that valuable? And
haven't we already learned the answer?
Wasn't that valuable to Penn?
Yeah,
it may be valuable to Barstool.
Go ahead, Button.
I don't think he converts people. It's that new better. Because I think I agree with Evan. Sorry, Scott, but I think
that's people right. He's are smarter than me on this. That's
people are loyal to what they use. So you order everything from Amazon. I don't look what the price is at Target or Walmart. I just click the button on Amazon. And,
really?
And I watch.
I'm paying you too much. That's it. That's the only thing I take away. That Sportico is paying Bodenhausen too much. That he does not comparison shop for all the Prada and Zegna stuff that he wears on a daily basis.
I watch it with my kids who have online accounts and. You know, they talk to their friends and they all use whatever they want to use. They stick with DraftKings and there's all sorts of loyalty bonuses and they're constantly tapping you on the shoulder to do something. And I think it is a more sophisticated gambler that is chasing that half point, I think, than the casual person that can be a serial user and be spending a lot of money.
All right, speaking of sophistication, let us pivot to WWE Raw. No more sophisticated program out there than that. But, I mean, I think we were all taken aback. And by the way, I say that as a kid who grew up as a WWE fan. I took my son to Madison Square Garden, and then he proceeded to beat the living crap out of me for a week with elbows to the back of the head. I mean, it is wonderful, wonderful, and I'm air quoting, family entertainment. He bought a Lucha Libre mask, of course, you know, so they got me for the merch, they got me for the food and bev. I was a wonderful per cap for WWE. Tickets, merch, food and bev. You know, hey, Dad, want more popcorn? I want a soda. I wanted it. So perfect. They love every bit out of me. But I was a kid. I went to Stony Brook University. I tell the story of meeting or having Big John Studd walk past me, and I was scared out of my mind. This guy was so big, and you know, he was like the nasty guy. You know, so he was the bad character. Scared the hell out of me. But I mean, we wake up to the headline.
Oh, that's a big boy. I just googled Big John Studd.
Oh, Big John. Two D's on Studd, by the way, right? Yeah. Two D's on Studd.
Yeah.
And by the way, I brought up Jim the Anvil Neidhart last time, and Kurt Eben had no idea who I was talking about. The Hart Foundation.
Of course.
Jimmy the Mouth. He doesn't know any of it. Just stop. But we wake up like multiple headlines from like Endeavor Properties the other day. It was like we had The Rock joining the board of TKO, right? Or WWE, what was it? What did he join the board?
I think TKO.
It was TKO board, right?
Yeah, TKO.
He joined the TKO board.
Which is the parent of UFC and WWE.
Parent of UFC, yeah. WWE, right? He gets the Rock back to the license for the Rock name. That is part of the deal. And by the way, he gets $30 million as part of that deal. But the bigger part, then boom, like 5 minutes later, I believe, is this announcement that Raw has signed a new deal with none other than Netflix. So do we say, what, $5 billion over 10 years, so $500 million a year, quick math by me. Do we say that Netflix, and the headline, Kurt, was that this is Netflix getting into live sports. Here we go, right? The dam is open, the floodgates, whatever you want to say. Am I considering this Netflix is getting into live sports, or am I considering this into scripted entertainment? What am I – is this akin to the NBA? Is this akin to the NFL? Or do you push this totally aside as a separate property?
I push it aside. I mean, it's sports-related content. I look at it as dipping your toes into documentaries. This is not live sports. This is sports and entertainment. And listen, I think it's a great move on both sides. I mean, they're talking about it's a doubling of what they were receiving before, $250 million a year. When this merger happened of WWE and UFC under the TKO banner, this was really what's going to happen with media. What's the future of it? And this, obviously, the market reacted very positively and looks at it as a strong deal. And this is a loyal audience. that has held up for decades now. So I don't think suddenly Netflix is, we've been waiting for Netflix to see what are they going to do in sports, what are they going to do in sports, really haven't touched it. And this just kind of seems more the same of their current strategy, whether it, you know, focus on documentaries and other related content and not live sports from my perspective.
I'm focused more on the other word. We can debate whether it's sports or not, but it is live. And that to me is an interesting thing for Netflix. Netflix has gradually dipped its toe in here. We've talked about, Scott, the Love is Blind fiasco, the crazy Love is Blind situation last year. They did that beautifully chaotic golf thing a couple months ago. I don't know if either of you guys watched that.
You know, I didn't.
But this is the most comprehensive thing Netflix, by a mile, that Netflix will be doing live. And to me, yeah, there's going to be a lot they're going to learn from that. And who knows? Maybe they do feel like suddenly having more appointment viewing live things, i.e. sports, is going to be valuable for them. Or maybe they do this for a while and realize, oh, we maybe don't want to be the appointment viewing app. We want to be the app that you binge, or the app that you watch at weird hours, or things like that. So, yeah, to me, the live part is interesting, is that this is the first kind of real appointment viewing live programming, to my knowledge, that Netflix is really paying up for. And that will be fascinating to see.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
I always think there's a lot, the shoulder programming seems to be just as important to Netflix as whatever that live would be. There's a million things creative they can do with wrestlers around simply showing the events. And we got sort of a peek at a strategy when Netflix was eyeing the World Surf League. Again, that's got to be a lifestyle thing. It's got to be more than just watching the ride of the wave. And there had to be so much more. And of course, they couldn't reach a deal. And it turns out, I believe today, as a matter of fact, World Surf reached a deal with ESPN. So a more traditional route. But whether it's Apple, whether it's YouTube, we're still waiting. Like, is ESPN, are they quaking in boots? You know, if I'm the NBA, I'm like, great. Anything that signals other people are getting involved and I'm looking to 2X, 3X, I'm very happy here. Because, and if you're ESPN, you got to have the NBA, right? You got to have the NFL. But the war chest for these other companies is just so much bigger. If they want it, they can get it. That is not a comfortable place for ESPN to be.
Yeah, there is a caveat there that the three of us have talked about before, which is I would bet that when these raw rights are up, even if Netflix wants to keep it, I'm not convinced there's going to be a huge increase in value. Like, I think that the way that these companies are thinking about these rights and because they have so much more money in other businesses, Scott, I do wonder if the leverage that they will use, not now, but they will use further down the line when they're more entrenched in this industry, is quite a bit different. So,
all right, well, how can
they have money, but I would be worried about their ever going willingness to spend it.
All right. Well, how can we possibly segue from such a discussion of these sort of alternate broadcasters, streaming, to MLS and Kurt's valuations? Is there a logical move there, Kurt? Is there some way we can tie together those two subjects? Because if there is, is there any way we can make a fruitful discussion here? I'll be typing it on my Macintosh. Keep it. If there's a way to do that, would you please do it for me?
Oh, very, very smooth transition. Yes, 100% MLS valuations. We entered 2023. Everybody was looking to Apple, looking to Leagues Cup. These two big initiatives, leagues banking on all these new fans coming in and opportunity ahead. And then they got a gift in their lap. Lionel, most famous person on the planet, decided to come play in their league.
This is where, hold on, Kurt. This is where we take 10, 20 seconds to debate. Leo Messi, most famous person on the planet? Really? Are we doing that?
On the Mount Rushmore, right?
I don't know.
The Pope. Is Messi Cristiano Ronaldo?
I would say Ronaldo's more famous than Messi right there. He's not even the most famous soccer player.
I don't know. And the World Cup may have changed that.
May have.
I think.
Yeah.
All right.
I think they're trending in opposite directions.
Let's go to the Bible of popularity. Let's go to the Bible of popularity. Who's going to look up the Instagram followers? That's all I need to know.
Well, well that is Ronaldo.
Ronaldo's
exactly. Number one on Instagram followers.
There we go. I knew you'd know.
Who rounds Messi out our Mount Rushmore here? The Pope, Cristiano Ronaldo, Messi, and who else are we putting on the most famous people in the world?
Most famous? Oh, boy. Man, this is tough. Most famous people. Like I always say, you know, like in the sports realm, I go I go The Rock. You know, Hollywood. Yeah, Taylor Swift.
A bunch of people. I don't know enough about Taylor Swift's popularity in non-English-speaking countries. It's certainly possible. Yeah.
Right. Anyway, we're back. Kurt, pick up where you left off. We are very good at tangents here, but if anybody wants to...
40 years ago, we would have said Arnold Schwarzenegger.
We would have.
It's,
Well, he vowed to be back, and he has not come back, so...
MLS. So listen, Messi sprinkled a little bit of pixie dust on all the clubs, but none more so than Inter Miami. Revenue more than double, and that was in half a season this year. They're looking at $200 million in revenue, which is just, I mean, from MLS economics, the average team generates $70 million. So they're going to be 3x what the average team does. And so, you know, but obviously Messi's only here for another two seasons. And so MLS has a great opportunity, but they have a great challenge because that's great. That's a great injection of cash, people spending money on sponsors, tickets, suites, all to see Messi. But you got to be thinking long term. How do you capitalize on this moment? And listen, all 29 teams and the league is focused on this idea. How do you know, because say 10 new fans came to MLS in 2023. 10 are not sticking around in 2026 when presumably Messi's gone, but it's also not zero. So they're trying to find out how many, what percentage of those fans we can keep long term. So they have a lot going for it. Great infrastructure in terms of the stadium. A lot of local environments have been incredible atmosphere. But you have some of these legacy teams desperately need new stadiums. And so that's where MLS is right now in terms of where they go from here.
What else? Give me your other headlines, or give me your average franchise value.
I want to talk some numbers real quick. For folks who haven't seen the list, LAFC number one, $1.15 billion. Atlanta United, Inter Miami, and LA Galaxy all above $1 billion.
But again,
but
let's tell people about Atlanta United. I still don't think that story gets told enough.
Okay.
Who was it that told us that the experience? Was it Arthur Blank himself who told
it
us?
It was Arthur
Atlanta?
Blank himself.
It was Arthur himself, the owner of both teams, when he said, frankly, the game day experience for Atlanta United is better than the Falcons.
Yeah, they have built an unbelievable following in there. It's interesting. LAFC, clear number one. And then you have three teams that are really close together, 2, 3, 4. You have Atlanta United number two, Inter Miami number three, LA Galaxy number four. And they're really bunched together in value. And it's really, what are you looking for? They offer three very different opportunities for anybody that was looking to buy one of those clubs. Inter Miami is the kind of shiny new toy. LA Galaxy has the legacy and is a soccer-specific stadium. And then Atlanta United plays in an NFL stadium, but incredible following, huge fan base. But MLS is really... And MLS works differently in the other leagues as a single entity, but they are really pushing the teams to think about revenue more so, and they are incentivizing them. And a big change last year was cutting the percentage of ticket revenue that the league keeps from 33% to 10%. So that helps clubs like LAFC, Atlanta United, that generate tons of ticket revenue. And, of course, it helped everybody that hosted Lionel Messi last year just in time.
Yeah, be honest, Kurt, because Eben and I both ran up against this for probably, I don't know, the last 5 years, Eben, where there was a lot of skepticism among the people who do these deals, the people who help arrange the buying and selling of NFL or NBA teams. A lot were on the sidelines. Clients would come to them and say, hey, this soccer thing, you know, I've been hearing about it for a while. Is this a place I should be looking? Is this an opportunity? Is it overvalued? Is it overhyped? And I think the answer from a lot of banker perspective for a lot of years was, yes, I think you should stay on the sidelines. I'm not a believer. And those people were not well served.
Yeah, it's a great point. And we've seen it in the past where, again, this is not the best soccer league in the world. That is very different than the NBA, the NFL, Major League Baseball. The global soccer ecosystem is much different. You have a lot of leagues competing for the same fans, the same corporate dollars, the same eyeballs. MLS has created good local environments, but it doesn't run across the whole league. There's traditionally been no TV money until now, and even some skeptics out there when the Apple deal was done, that there wasn't much TV money there when you're talking about $8 million on average for an annual rights fee per team. And so, again, I think the jury's still out. Revenue multiples have compressed as the league has grown up a little bit. Revenues are up a lot, so no longer is it the most valuable or richest sports league in the world when it comes to revenue multiples. The NBA, with their soaring values, is past it. So it needs to continue to grow. There's a lot of work for MLS to do, but there's a lot of opportunity ahead leading into 2026 World Cup.
I see. I've been smiling. I just want to see if the words revenue or creative are going through his head. That's a follow of our last podcast. I just see if he was going there.
Never again. I actually want to stick on the revenue multiples for a second, Kurt, because I agree with you, Scott, that there's no doubt that the way the market thinks about MLS has changed dramatically in the last 5 years. I have been curious if that was because of MLS, changes in MLS business, or if that was because of change in everything else, in that they changed the way they thought about valuations in every other league. Because it seems to me, because of the revenue multiples you're talking about, that in some ways the way people were valuating other teams has moved towards the way we were valuating MLS teams, right? The average NBA team sells now for a higher multiple than MLS. That to me indicates that maybe people were wrong about the other teams, other leagues.
Somebody's paying
about
attention
MLS.
To our Lev Akabas graphics. Somebody's paying attention to the data viz.
I think there is some of that going on. I think that there was a case, as popular and as attractive as the franchises were, that NFL teams and NBA teams have been grossly undervalued.
Yeah.
If you look at the run-up in valuations. And MLS fed, they've kind of been caught up in this tailwind with, you can't buy an NBA team, you can't buy an NFL team, because it costs you $4 billion, $5 billion, $6 billion to get one of those. But you really want to be a sports owner, MLS is a nice option where you could buy control of a team for a couple hundred million dollars. And if you don't have a couple hundred million dollars, well, then you start looking at NWSL and WNBA. So, it filters all the way down. The appetite to be a sports team owners is insatiable right now, and that helps raise the bar for all these teams.
I do want to mention real quick before we wrap that there are 10 NHL teams worth less than those big four MLS teams that Kurt mentioned. So there's four MLS teams worth more than $1 billion. There are 10 NHL teams that's Kurt and Sportico currently value below $1 billion. So just to give people a sense of how MLS and its gradual upward creep is starting to kind of mesh its way in with the NHL, there is a lot of overlap. If you look at all of the North American teams by valuation, there's a decent chunk of overlap at the top of MLS and the bottom of NHL.
Well, we also have, let's look at tailwinds, headwinds. We are coming up to a few pretty big soccer events coming into North America. And in fact, the women's broadcast deal is sort of, looking to take advantage of that very World Cup.
For sure.
I only see it growing right now, Kurt. Do you see tailwind versus headwind? What do you see?
The headwind really is what happens next. There's only one Messi, but there's a lot of conversation is how do we bring in more players and how do you compete with the bankrolls of the EPL, the Saudi League, La Liga, across the board. And so there's certainly a contingent of owners that want to go full steam ahead and spend, and they need to raise the level of play on the field. But listen, the reality is that they're all after debt service, they're basically all losing money as it is right now. And so there's a lot of different things being talked about right now. There's talk of maybe a player acquisition fund that could be supported by a third party. Maybe some institutional money comes in and writes a check to help spur this process on. The MLS has done it before, where they sold a stake in some back in 2012 before buying it back. So right now they're figuring out what the future looks like in terms of the rules, because they want MLS to be a top five league, not just franchise valuations. We did global franchise values last year, 18 of the top 50 were MLS. But that's the closed ecosystem props up the values of all these teams, not having to worry about relegation. They want to be a top five league on the field, and they are not there right now.
2027 is going to be the definitive year in MLS, in my opinion. The World Cup, the American, North American World Cup will be in the rearview mirror. Leo Messi will probably be gone. And I think those two things will combine to really level set where MLS is.
Yep.
Without Messi here, without the bauble that everybody talks about, the World Cup here in the U.S. in 2026, with that in the rearview mirror, I think we're going to really have a sense of what the appetite is here for MLS, how good the quality is on the field, what Messi's impact did and didn't do from a sustainability standpoint. I think 2027 is the year that things really shake out in terms of what MLS clubs are worth and where the league goes from there.
What New York restaurant will host the Kylian Mbappe welcome to MLS press conference? Do we know? What do we think?
It's French. La Bernardin? La Bernardin, right?
La Bernardin is where Kylian Mbappe will be welcome to MLS. Perfect. I love it. That's what it's going to be. Bodenhausen, you know we love when you join us. I love that it was beyond just the valuations today. But again, if I may, in this very public forum, dude, love it. I mean, you know, I'm up at midnight when it publishes. I like to see the immediate.
That makes one of us.
I'm up for a number of reasons, but that's really one of them. I like to promote it early, and I like to see the feedback and the way it just gets pushed around the world. I love every single time you do it. I love it. Great work, and we appreciate you joining us.
Agreed. And for folks who want more Kurt, you can find him on Twitter at K. Bodenhausen. Scott for more Scott at Soshnik. You can find me
Nobody wants more Evan at Novi_World.
The show is produced by Aaron Greenewald. Thank you very much to Aaron. Sportico's digital media editor, Cora Veltman, would like you to know that you can follow the Sporticast, the show at Sporticast,
little stumble right there,
which is the hub of the Sportico Media Network.
Right before the line.